Travis and I did not plan the title of that song and the title of this study, but they could have gone together, and I hope they will. We have been involved over the last several Sunday evenings in a study of the people of God and the world and the prophets. And we've tried to think our way through each of the 12 minor prophets now. And I felt like it would be important that we take one last opportunity to look at the years in between the closing of that prophetic age and then the ministry of Christ. And I hope tonight we'll be able to encourage ourselves and kind of thinking about our place in the world in this way. I'm so grateful to have each of you present. It's been a really busy, not only day, but I know a whole weekend, thanks to you ladies who've been involved Friday and Saturday in the retreat activities for all of your work. Thanks also for the delicious lunch that I'm sure all your husbands prepared for today. And it really was a good time together, and we appreciated your work. Thanks to those of you who've been involved in getting LTC activities lined up and planned, and for your willingness to help mentor our young people in that activity. Congratulations to Clyde and Ann, and we wish them the best, and we're glad as a congregation to be able to celebrate together. Kay and I thank you for the prayers, not only for the business, but also for Carrie and Justin. And we'll be, Lord willing, we'll be there with them for 3 or 4 days, and then we'll be back next Lord's Day. And next Lord's Day, we will, Lord willing, we will do the third one of this little series for Sunday morning, and then next Sunday evening, we plan a prayer time together with regard to these three studies. So I hope you can plan to be with us for that. I want to try to do this as briefly as I can tonight, although, give me credit for this, this is 450 years basically, so I got my work to get that done, and to get you out in time to watch the Indians tonight would be good work. We hope it will be of interest to each one of you. While they were waiting, the between the testaments developments, remember that after the work of Malachi, we mentioned last Lord's Day evening that a period of about 435 years pass when there is not a speaking prophet. They're not men like Malachi or Zechariah or Haggai coming along to explain what's going on and to encourage the people and to keep them faithful. Instead, they have the words of those who have already spoken. And this is a period of time in which we might have thought, well, maybe God is not being all that active. Maybe he's taking some time away from this scheme of redemption to allow some reforming and regathering of spiritual energy for the whole process. And if we think that, we would be missing a very important fact. And the fact is that God had, even though he had not been speaking through these prophets as he had, it did not mean that he hadn't been at work. This is a very important realization with regard to God's activity and his providence and in his world and his plans and purposes. I liken it in my mind to what happened when the descendants of Abraham went down into Egypt and were 430 years there multiplying and becoming a great nation and feeling the need of their slavery and their need for redemption out of that terrible ordeal. in which God was at work when it didn't look like He was. He was preparing a nation and fulfilling His purposes and getting ready to judge the gods of Egypt and to ransom a people for Himself. And I when I look at the intertestamental period, it's somewhat like that. And what I observe is that a reader of the New Testament, someone who starts out reading the New Testament, if he has freshly read the Old Testament, very quickly notices that there are some institutions and some practices and some people present here among the Jews at this period of time who were not there in Old Testament days. And in Old Testament days, there's been such an emphasis upon following the pattern that God has given to His people and the prophets calling the people to faithfulness that we may wonder, well, where did this all come from? And there's an answer to this. And I'd like for us to be aware that the answer to this question helps us in great measure to see what God has done to get ready for the time to be right for the gospel. I've broken this up in my mind at least to five different aspects of New Testament life that are different, and I want to think about that with you for these few minutes. For some reason, I ended up with a D and an S in the beginning of all these phrases, so think of it that way. First off, God was at work in developing a setting in which the gospel of Christ would be needed and would be appreciated by those who had hearts for it and would be able to grow and to spread and to be acted upon. Three things happen among the people during this this period between the Testament. One is the formation of a Jewish identity, which involved a responsibility for what had gone on before and an expectation that the promises of God were yet to be fulfilled. The captivity was in part to refine the people. We read in Malachi chapter 3 last week where they would come out like gold or silver that had been through the fire. When they got finished with captivity, there was in the minds of the people a devotion to the law of God. What had been refined out of their lives was any patience for idolatry. And whatever happens to them from that time forward at least does not involve the degrading idolatry that had brought God's judgment on Jerusalem in the time of the kings. They whatever happens to them from then on, they have an identity that sets them apart from the pagan world around them. The pagan gods, the behaviors and so forth of the people, and then some of the religious activities of the Jewish people helped to solidify that identity as well. Things like the Sabbath observance and the practice of circumcision and some of the feasts and that they observed, and then the food laws and so forth, the carefulness about those things. What happens in these years is while the Jews are coming out of captivity and the ones of them who wanted to were going back to the land of Judah, the nations are going through the process of changing as well. Around them, the Persian rulers were beginning their decline. In about 332, 333 B.C., a young man we know as Alexander the Great began to conquer and to spread the Greek culture all over the civilized world of the time. This Greek way of life became a very powerful force which would serve later on to enable the gospel to spread. It involved the learning of a common language. It involved sort of a movement from the Eastern mindset more to the Western mindset, which we would be more aware of now. It involved an appreciation for learning and organization and that sort of thing beyond the different little regions or states that had existed, like Judea and Syria and so on during that period of time. And then upon Alexander the Great's death, he had conquered so much territory that really the realm was divided up among his generals. And as a result of that, the people who were living in the neighborhood of Jerusalem and occupying the land again found themselves torn back and forth for many years between the Seleucid rulers, who were the one of Alexander the Great's rulers who were of Syrian descent, and the Ptolemies, who were the ones who were of Egyptian descent. And if you imagine a bone with a dog on one end and a dog on the other end and them fighting over it, that's sort of what the people in Judea found themselves dealing with during this period of time. One would get powerful for a while and the other would get powerful for a while, and especially the Syrian rulers were a disaster for the people of Judah and tried to enforce upon them degrading idolatry. Even one, Antiochus Epiphanes, even causing them to offer a pig on the altar of the temple and causing a great uproar. It led to a revolt among Jewish leaders. We refer to them as the Maccabees usually. And that goes on for a long period of time. Very, very important battle with outside forces that the people and the land go through during that period of time. And they start the long struggle of how do we react as a religious people to civil rulers or forces that occupy our land and try to make us subservient to them. Do we rebel against them? Do we withdraw from them? Do we compromise with them? How do we manage that? This goes on until about 63 B.C. when the Roman general Pompey conquers the area and the land of Judah becomes a territory ruled by Roman power now. And it goes along during this period of time. The Romans finally appoint a king who is an Edomian, a descendant of Esau, the man we know as Herod the Great. And Herod the Great, in order to pacify those who objected to an Edomite trying to rule over them, began building projects, one of which was to try to restore the temple to its glory from the time of Solomon. That becomes an important thing during the time of Jesus, of course. The thing about it is, Herod the Great was a cruel and ungodly man who tried to practice an outward form of Judaism only as a political tool. We remember him as the king who killed all the babies 2 years old and under, perhaps, in Bethlehem later on. These three forces now, the Jewish identity, the Greek culture, and the Roman powers enforced peace. Nobody had the courage to try to rebel against them, and their soldiers kept calm and kept people safe in their form of so doing. And their transportation, their way of connecting their territories by means of roads will have an important role to play in this place. Now, all of that together, Jewish identity, Greek culture, and Roman peace and roads, forms an important setting for the other things that we're going to try to notice. The second part of the story that's important in the New Testament is what we hear referred to sometimes as the diaspora, the scattering of the people. Remember that the ones who wanted to return to the land got to do so with Zerubbabel and then with Ezra and then with Nehemiah and maybe other times. The other people from a Jewish background were not, they didn't end. They were scattered abroad to every town and every city, and they resettled in these different places. So by the New Testament days, when the day of Pentecost comes, for example, there are devout men from Jews, devout men from every nation. In Acts 2, Peter writes to those who are of those elect, who are the exiles of the dispersion, he calls them, 1 Peter 1 and verses 1 and 2. Caiaphas in John 11 and verse 52 mentions the children of God who are scattered abroad and he thought would be gathered back together. So this was an important thing in their minds. There is a Jewish presence in all the communities throughout that area and all the way across Asia Minor and to the Greek peninsula, to even to Rome. And remember what we've already learned about how they stand out and are different from the other peoples who would be around. They provided a strong contrast to the pagan way of thinking and living and acting. As some of the people from a Gentile background experienced the situation, they began to admire the Jews' devotion to one God and not this pantheon of Greek or Roman gods. They grew to admire the more disciplined Jewish way of living morally, and to detest the immorality of the pagan world around them. And many of these people developed an attraction for the God the Jews worshipped. They're known in the New Testament as the God-fearers or the devout. Some of them were converted to Judaism, and we meet several proselytes in the New Testament as well, people who generally had an open heart for God. While this is going on, these Jews who have this presence and who contrast with the world around them are also developing a very, very strong sense of expectation about the fulfillment of the promises the prophets we've been reading had made. Remember when we end the Old Testament, it talks about the coming of one who's going to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children to the fathers, someone who would be like the day spring from on high, bringing light for the people. That kind of thing is found in some section of almost each one of the minor prophets, along, of course, with the great promises by Isaiah and people like him. David led us tonight in prayer that the Lord would come soon. And that really is it. They didn't understand what that would mean. But the idea of the kingdom being taken away from the world and the kingdom of God being restored and so forth, that was a powerful motivating factor in the lives of the Jews at during this period of time. So we have the setting and then the scattering of the people, the people of Jewish background who know of the God of the Old Testament, of the prophets and the promises and all that, their presence in all these different places throughout the Roman world. And then the third step in the process is the distinctiveness, I should have used the word the distinctiveness here, of the synagogue. During the intertestamental period, the focus of Jewish life and attention moves away from the temple in Jerusalem and the practices that might have gone on there to the synagogues And each of the scattered towns and cities where each one of these Jewish communities lived, the synagogues, we haven't read about in the Old Testament, but they're an important part of the New Testament story and even of the development of the church. The word means assembly or congregation. The synagogue involved both a building, which was called the synagogue, but then the people, the synagogue, the gathering, the congregation. And this is the place where, generally speaking, their loyalty to each other and their devotion to God and the tone and the nature of their lives were focused here in this part of their lives at the time. It became the center of community life. It's where education of the children took place, finally. It's where disputes were settled and judgments were made between people. It's where the Lord's Word was read every Sabbath day and where the people came to know of the commandments of God and of His promises and of what devotion to Him looked like. The synagogue had its officers, its customs, its way of conducting its services and so forth, which had a big impact on the lives of the people. We read in Acts 15 that in every city, Moses was read and had been for many years every Sabbath day, and that was a concern that the apostles had to take place and how the liberty of the gospel was to be understood and practiced. The synagogues become a crucial institution in terms of the spread of the gospel. On the missionary journeys, where did Paul and his co-workers go first? Always to the synagogues. They could find there a people who were interested in the God of the Old Testament and people who were familiar with the moral life that children of God would pursue and who had some acquaintance with the promises of the Scriptures. And in that way, they were like a field which had been prepared for the harvest and for the sowing of the seed of the kingdom, the gospel of Christ. Their devotion in these synagogues was directed as a result of the intertestamental period to the Scriptures. Something that we kind of take for granted. You notice that how easily we expect there to be a book for us to read, and if we don't have a book, then it's on our phone or a tablet or something else. These folks didn't have that type of situation. They had it read to them in the synagogue on the Sabbath day from scrolls. I had an opportunity some years ago to go to a Jewish synagogue service. And what I noticed was, even then, and this wasn't in the intertestamental period, however much you might think that, even then, they had a large scroll of the Torah, the law, and it occupied the place in their building that the baptistry generally does in ours. It had a chain and a medal around it. It was kept wrapped up in a cloth and so forth. And their devotion to Scripture really formed during the intertestamental period. And you can see it a bit as the Old Testament age is winding down with Ezra and Nehemiah. Remember, in Nehemiah would be the civil governor or ruler, and when he wants to help restore the spiritual life of the people, he would get Ezra the scribe to read from the law or from the Scriptures. And since the language was beginning to turn from Hebrew to Aramaic, still a like Hebrew, but a different dialect of it. Ezra would read it and then explain it to tell the people what it meant. And they'd be sitting down and he'd be standing, and it was just a wonderful arrangement. And that's how the people would learn it. It was already developing during that period of time. But what do you do in a less centralized situation? Well, very carefully the scriptures were copied, and manuscripts of the scriptures were spread through the countryside. And we know about some of this from things like the Dead Sea Scrolls, for example. Very, very important witnesses to the text of the Old Testament that really come from this period of time. During this time, the scribes do their work. That's what Ezra was. That simply means they were learned. They were experts in reading and writing and that kind of thing. They were in a position to make good use of these materials. They copied or wrote and read, and people relied on them. The rabbis come along. They are the teachers, the respected teachers in the synagogues. And the rabbis' teachings about these things are soon collected into the Talmud, and then the various translations of those take the form of the Targums. And so the people had the law, and then what the rabbi said about the law, and then the commentaries on it by people, and all of that kind of thing showed how important it was. An extremely significant aspect of this happens about 250 B.C. in Alexandria in Egypt. Alexandria had a great library, a famous library, and in order to make it more complete, it is said that the ruler there commissioned a translation of the Hebrew, the book of the Hebrews, the Old Testament. And the story is that 70 scholars were commissioned to translate the Hebrew scriptures into the Greek language, which was spoken throughout the world at that period of time. This becomes an extremely important step in the process. This translation is known as the Septuagint, or you'll hear it, you'll see it in Roman numerals, LXX, the 70. It's the Greek Old Testament. And those of you who have, in reading your English Bible, you'll notice an Old Testament verse that will be cited in the New Testament. The Old Testament being written in Hebrew, the New Testament in Greek, and you'll notice that the wording is different, and you think to yourself, well, these guys got it wrong. What you really have is them quoting, usually, from the Greek translation of the Old Testament, and when they cite these places in the New Testament. And the outgrowth of this is that this allows the scriptures to be read and understood by the common people throughout a settled world under Roman power during that time. Can you think of how important that would have been ultimately for the spread of the gospel? Wow. The traditions, how people had, what others had said about the law, and then the various uninspired writings, the most famous of which are known as the Apocrypha and the Pseudepigrapha. You don't need to know maybe what those terms, one is hidden and one is people writing under an assumed name. They're not inspired, but they help to show the prevalence of them, helps to show people had these things on their minds and they were concerned about what the scripture meant and how the purposes of God would be carried out. Now, along with that, and if you followed with me, we've talked about the setting and the scattering and the synagogue and the scriptures I need to talk about the Jewish sectarian groups who are we read about in the New Testament as well. The divisions among the Jews, interestingly, are almost totally based on how these different groups thought they should respond to the pagan rulers who were in their land and who were taking taxes from them and who were, in their mind, keeping the kingdom from being restored to Israel. It's interesting that in our thinking about government and voting and all that kind of thing, if we're not careful, we could do this kind of dividing into groups. It's interesting to me, at least, to think about these different ones. Now, I've always thought, well, everybody in among the Jews was one or the other of those. And I read in working on this lesson, actually, there are only about 7% of the population who belong to one of these groups. And the fact that they appear so often in the New Testament tells you what kind of sway they seem to have. First one is the Sadducees. The Sadducees were tended to be the ones who, for some reason, had been given the high priestly or the priestly power by the authorities at the time. They weren't Levites, but they're given the power. One of them would be the chief priest. And consequently, the Sadducees were the guys who believed that, you know, we don't necessarily like all these rulers, but we have to get along with them. Besides that, we're making our living off of them. So whatever little compromises we have to make about spiritual things, hey, that's life, and we'll go along that way. And the Sadducees tended to be wealthier because they were more powerful and thus more concerned with the status quo, keeping it like it was, not rocking the boat. The Sadducees, interestingly, did not believe in, they believed only in the first five books of the Old Testament, generally speaking. They did not believe in angels or the spirit world necessarily. They didn't believe in resurrection. They were basically the secular Jews in that way. Next, there are the Pharisees. The Pharisees are the descendants of the Hasmoneans or the Hasidic, we hear them that way, referred to that way. The Hasidic leaders, who among the, whom were the Maccabees, are really descended from the Maccabees, the ones who said, who thought, let us not have anything to do with the world that's represented by these leaders. Let us keep ourselves apart from anything that might defile us. Let us not only keep the letter of law, but keep one step farther back from the letter of the law, so that we can be separate. Now, the Pharisees were the largest one of these groups, and the ones that got the most attention, of course, during the lifetime of Jesus. They believed in the resurrection. They believed in angels. They believed in life beyond this and so forth. In that way, we would think of them as spiritual-minded, but they went about it in a way that, as you remember from the controversies of Jesus, which involved the outside way more than it did the inside. Is it possible to respond to concerns about the world by simply trying to keep ourselves aside from it in a way where we don't become any better than it? In the third place, there are the Essenes. The Essenes are the ones whose response is to basically withdraw. and live in almost what would be called a sort of a monastic type of life. They retreat to places like Masada or places out in the edge of the wilderness, along the desert areas, away from everybody, not having anything to do with them, to give themselves to contemplation and reading the scripture and prayer, and they'd make a living maybe in a communal kind of way. And the people who were responsible for the Dead Sea Scrolls are people who were Essenes like this, the ones who are remembered for Masada are Essenes who keep away, who want to keep themselves away from the whole thing, just have nothing to do with any of it. Get off to ourselves. And then there are the Zealots. One of the apostles was actually Simon the Zealot. He's always mentioned right before Judas Iscariot. And in the King James Version, he's sometimes referred to as Simon the Canaanite, but the word for Canaanite means zealot. Zealots were a party whose response was a very, very emotional one, and who were very fiery about it, and who wanted to throw the bums out. Rebellion if we have to. Physical violence if we have to. Let's rid ourselves of the Roman yoke. It's interesting that Jesus has among the 12 a zealot who would have manned to be on the Roman side would have been unthinkable, and a publican who collected taxes for the Romans. Only Jesus could put two fellows like that on the same team. I wonder at us today to spend all of a campaign season calling each other bad names and then saying, let's come together. What's going to draw us together? And that's what you see in the thinking of these guys here, the zealots. And then the other group you run across sometimes in the New Testament are the Herodians. Herodians are thought to be the people who were devoted to a restoration of the governing power of the Herod family, but only to be free of the Roman involvement in it. Let the Herods be king and mean it, not responsible to an emperor, and let them appoint the priests and so forth, instead of having the Roman emperor do it. Well, all of that, of course, creates a certain atmosphere now in which we bring with us when we come to the New Testament. And I'll just make these two comments about it in closing. I hear echoing in my mind what Matthew says in Matthew 9 and verse 36, how Jesus looks out at the people and he sees them distressed and scattered as sheep having no shepherd. That's what happens in this period between the Testament. They had no shepherd, but they wanted one. They needed one. And you remember Galatians 4 and verse 4, but when the fullness of time was come, one of the paraphrases has, but at just the right time, God sent forth His Son, born of woman, born under the law, to redeem us. Just the right time. What made it that way? The providence of God did, and the purpose of God took advantage of it. And you and I have been able to hear the gospel because of that. I hope we'll count our blessings, that we'll contemplate how what seems to us like forever, 20 years, how that looks in comparison to 435 when God was at work, but nobody could see it. He still is. And we want to be we want to bear that in mind as we try to live for Him today. If you're here wanting to become a Christian tonight, to make the good confession and to be baptized into Christ, we'd love to help you if you let us know by coming here to the front while we stand and sing.